Gaza has claimed more than 350 lives in the past day, raising the death toll to nearly 17,200. And Israel approves plans to build nearly 2,000 new settler units in the occupied east outputs amid its relentless strikes against the besieged Gaza Strip. Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. More than 2 months into Israel's deadliest onslaught on the Gaza Strip, the regime relentlessly continues with its all-out aggression, leaving over 17,000 Palestinians dead. Regime forces have massacred a Palestinian family in their latest attack on a school for refugees near the Indonesian hospital north of the coastal strip. Dozens of Palestinians have also been killed in fresh airstrikes on the southern cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah. Israeli warplanes also hit two homes in the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza, leaving nearly 30 people dead. Meanwhile, on the ground, heavy fighting is raging in several cities, including Khan Yunis. Hamas says it has killed several Israeli troops in the latest battles, bringing the total death toll in the Israeli military since the ground operation to 90. The resistance group has also destroyed two dozen military vehicles in Khan Yunis and the northern city of Beit Lahia. Palestinians sifted through the rubble to search for casualties after Israeli warplanes struck a residential area in the southern Gaza town of Rafah late Wednesday. Let's take a listen to eyewitness accounts of indiscriminate Israeli strikes on the town.
There were three big explosions. Then we saw a strike in the apartment up there. It was my brother's apartment. It was completely destroyed. A large number of people were martyred and wounded. Most of them were children and women.
It was a direct hit. People were walking on the street. There was no warning. We didn't see anything except a strike on our homes without any warning.
We are from Al-Hobi family in Rafah. We were surprised by the attack. The house was targeted by three rockets. They targeted women and children and displaced Palestinians. They were told the south would be safe. The south is supposed to be safe. Our guests were displaced from Hamad to Rafah and they were all killed. This is the occupation and its actions.
Israel's genocidal onslaughts on Gaza have forced Palestinians to live in squalid tent camps without basic necessities. Take a listen to some Palestinians telling about the dire situation in those camps.
The conditions in the camps are extremely challenging. When the rains start to fall, we rush to cover the tent, trying to stop water infiltration. The situation is extremely difficult as we have been striving to secure food, water, and firewood. We struggle to bring firewood to set a fire to cook food for our children and warm them. We're struggling with another war in addition to the ongoing war. It's a battle for survival to secure food and water and to be able to go on. What can we do? It's a life imposed on us. God willing, this war ends and the permanent, not temporary ceasefires to be applied so that we can go back home and live even honorable, which is much better than a life of humiliation. Our situation has been compounded by rocketing prices that were tripled.
Winter is harder than this ongoing war where we live inside tents, a primordial life. We are living like our ancestors lived before 1948. Everyone is struggling due to the winter, and the tents are already submerged. We're trying to adapt to our current situation as much as we can. Hopefully, we can return to our homes and live a better life. This is all we can say.
The United Nations World Food Program says Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are facing alarming levels of hunger due to a lack of food. In a report, the UN agency said that at least 97% of households in northern Gaza have inadequate food consumption, with 9 out of 10 people going one full day and night without food. This is while southern Gaza has also been experiencing acute food shortages, with a third of households said to be suffering from severe or very severe hunger. Since the onset of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, over 1,200 trucks carrying food aid have entered the besieged Palestinian territory. But WFP, in its report, says 100 trucks with food are needed each day to meet the basic needs of the civilian population in Gaza. In a rare move, the UN Secretary General has invoked what is widely considered to be the most powerful diplomatic tool to turn the attention of the Security Council toward the humanitarian crisis in the besieged Gaza Strip.
Given the scale of the loss of human life in Gaza and in Israel in such a short amount of time, the Secretary General has today delivered a letter to the President of the Security Council invoking Article 99 of the Charter of the United Nations. This is the first time that Antonio Guterres has done this since he became Secretary General in 2017. Article 99 states, and I quote, that the Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter in his opinion that may threaten the maintenance of international peace and security. In the letter, which has been shared with you, the Secretary General urges the members of the Security Council to press to avert a humanitarian catastrophe, and he appeals for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared.
In the letter, Antonio Guterres calls on the Security Council, as well as the international community, to use all available means to stop Israel's massacre of Palestinians. Response to Guterres' letter, the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Josep Borrell, has urged the European members of the 15-member Council to immediately prevent a full collapse of the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Also, a short draft resolution was circulated to Council members by the United Arab Emirates, demanding an immediate ceasefire while expressing grave concern over the situation in the Palestinian territory. Israeli forces have carried out new raids across the occupied West Bank. That has resulted in clashes with Palestinians at several places. Regime troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at Palestinian youths during the clashes. Earlier, they raided several neighborhoods, which resulted in the death of one Palestinian. Several others were injured and dozens were arrested as well. The Israeli military also deployed dozens of armored vehicles while entering the city of Tulkarm and laying siege to the Nur Shams refugee camp. The occupying regime has stepped up its deadly attacks across the West Bank since October 7. That is when Israel launched a genocidal onslaught against the people in the besieged Gaza Strip. Over 260 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories since then. Israel has approved plans to build 1,738 new settler units in the occupied East Al-Quds amid the regime's genocidal onslaught against the besieged Gaza Strip. Peace Now, which is an Israel-based NGO, said the new settler units will effectively obstruct the last remaining corridor connecting two major Palestinian neighborhoods in East Al-Quds with the rest of the city. It added that the plan makes the creation of a Palestinian urban continuum in East Al-Quds practically impossible. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry said on Tuesday that Israel has taken advantage of international concerns over the war in Gaza to approve the construction of the new settlements. The ministry added that the regime plans to flood Al-Quds with settlements and settlers to separate the city from its Palestinian surroundings. All Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law as they have been constructed on occupied land. Salina Khan is an independent journalist who joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the program, Salina Khan. Taking a look at, first of all, and it's really hard to be talking about this after 2 months that it's continued, and this is the number of Palestinians that have been murdered, which is now standing at over 17,000. We have, of course, the number that have been injured. That stands at around 60,000. And then you have the ones that are under the rubble, which are still unaccounted for. That is set to be around 10,000. And the World Health Organization has said the diseases are going to result in more deaths than the actual figures that have been killed so far. What do you think of these apocalyptic numbers that you're hearing?
Yeah, of course. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me. And these numbers are atrocious. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we as Muslims in the U.S. are trying to do. The problem is that just like Palestine needs to be liberated, our mosques in the U.S. also need to be liberated. 90% of mosques in the U.S. are occupied right now. And it's really hard to effectively do anything for the Palestinians. The imams and the boards that are part of the mosques, are they all beholden to the U.S. government, which we all know is the biggest ally and supporter of the Zionist regime. But Biden said if there was no Israel, we'd have to create it, obviously to accomplish the American objectives in the region. So these imams at the mosques, not only do they not guide the Muslims correctly as to how we who are living in the belly of the Zionist support system should stop U.S. support for Israel, but some actually are trying to stop their communities from actions that will help Palestinians, which is very, very sad and tragic. And to understand this better, I think we need to go back to 9/11 and the war on terror and how those events affected the imams and mosques in the U.S. They were afraid of being labeled terrorists and deported or thrown into jail. So Muslim imams in general adopted the strategy of complete radio silence on U.S. foreign policy. For several years, they didn't even mention anything that was happening. But then the kids, they needed guidance, so they started looking for this guidance on the internet and were getting misled, putting the imams of the mosque they attended in hot water. So an example is the so-called Nigerian underwear bomber, for example. The mosque realized that they cannot be completely silent anymore. So if we fast forward to today, and we're seeing this whole-scale massacre of the Palestinians, it's forced the imams and the Muslim organizations, they have to speak out. They just can't be silent anymore. The videos and information on social media means everybody knows what's happening, and they're looking for the Muslim leadership for guidance on how they should help. So while the imams are speaking up, and that's a good start, them repeating everything that we already see on social media isn't enough. The guidance most mosques have been giving to us is to dua for the Palestinians. Get up in the middle of the night, do the Hajj prayer, and do dua. The more activist type of imams add that we should share information on social media and attend protests and rallies. Of course, this is important, but it's not enough. The massacre continues even after millions of people have been attending rallies. There was an Israeli education official who gave a speech at a university in the U.S. some years back, and he said, "We don't care about people coming to the streets to rally. They do this for about 6 to 8 weeks, and they go home, and we're still here." So there's a concept of infaq in the Quran, which is getting what is needed to who needs it when they need it. So in this context, we would mean that what do the Palestinians need from us now? We are at that 8 week mark now. Will the mosque guide us on what we should do after these rallies? The problem is the Muslim leaders are not doing infaq. They're not offering solutions that are most effective and most needed by Palestinians. So I can share you an example, my personal experience in the city where I live. When Israel started bombing the Palestinians in early October, I approached 5 or 6 mosques and Islamic organizations, and I said, you know, we need to organize some protests. Either I got no response, or the responses I got were really pathetic, like, no, we're really worried about security concerns, or our lawyer told us we shouldn't get involved in this issue. So as a result of that, I had to turn to non-Muslims and some secular Muslims to organize for Palestine. And for about a month, we held protests every week. At first, there was just a few hundred coming, but by the fourth or fifth one, we had several thousand people attending our rallies. So at this point, the local mosques who have the deepest ties with like the FBI and who engage in dialogue and normalization with local Zionists, they stepped in to co-opt our efforts. And they said, now we're going to organize the next rally. So what kind of rally did they want to organize? From just the poster of the rally, you can figure out a lot. There was a heart on the poster with the American flag, and on it, there was no mention of the word Palestine at all. Instead, it was called a peace rally. They wanted to neutralize the issue from the end of genocide and end of occupation to make peace. When some of us said imams who are normalizers with Zionists should not be leading the Palestinian cause, they stepped back, and now they are doing their work through the youth who they have recruited. In addition, the actions that they are offering are really useless and nearly useless. Like they say, call your representative, vote for this person, don't vote for that person. These are all tools offered by the oppressor that will never help the oppressed. So not only are the Muslim leaders offering ineffective actions, but those imams are trying to sabotage any real efforts made by Muslims that are trying to do something, such as disruption and direct actions. In the movement, rallies are good to get people together on the streets and find others who are willing to do the work. But after that, you have to move on.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for those thoughts. Selina Khan, independent journalist there from Nashville. Thank you. Moving on, Yemen's armed forces have seized several Israel-linked vessels in the Red Sea in response to the regime's genocide in Gaza. In a televised interview with Iran's Arabic news network, Al Alam, the commander of the Yemeni Coastal Defense Forces, Mohammad al-Qadiri, says the Red Sea is safe except for Israeli ships and anyone that does business using ships of the Zionist regime.
We announced to the world, the international community, and the UN Security Council that the international passage of the Red Sea is safe and under our protection. And we do provide the security to the Red Sea, except for Israeli ships and anyone who does business using ships of the Zionist regime. The Red Sea and the Arabian Sea are completely safe. We are responding to the desperate calls of our brothers in Gaza and the Palestinian nation. We respond to the call of the women and children in Gaza who are under the threat of death and destruction on a daily basis before the eyes of the world. We as Muslims and Arabs respond to their calls. We have resisted, prepared ourselves, and are ready to defend Palestine. Even if Saudi Arabia, which used to attack us, comes under attack by any Israeli or American military force, we will defend it. This is about Islam, about being an Arab. Yes, even Saudi Arabia. With God's help, we will reach Al-Quds. Neither the Yemeni nation nor the Yemeni armed forces should be underestimated.
U.S. Senate Republicans have blocked an emergency spending bill aimed at providing billions of dollars in a new military assistance package for Ukraine and Israel. The vote was 49 in favor to buy, 251 against. But 60 votes were needed in the 100-member Senate to begin debating the $110.5 billion package. The Republicans pressed their demand that U.S. home security should come first. They cited immigration control mechanisms at the Mexico border. Part of the new package would have provided nearly $50 billion in military and economic assistance for Kiev. It also allocated $14 billion of military assistance for Israel. The minority leader, Mitch McConnell, said the Senate needed to meet America's national security priorities. Iran's president says the issue of Palestine and the brutal aggression, Israeli aggression against Palestinians, will be top on the agenda during his official visit to Russia.
Another point which has turned into a concern for the region and the Muslim Ummah and all the freedom-seeking nations of the world. I'm referring to the ongoing developments in Gaza and what is happening to the innocent Palestinian people. So the issue of Palestine will be one of the major topics of discussion, and the need for an immediate action for halting the bombardment of Gaza.
Raisi said lifting the years-long Israeli blockade on Gaza and providing support to the Palestinians will be among the top topics to be discussed. The president made the remarks before embarking on a day-long trip to Moscow, where he is set to meet with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. And then Raisi said enhancing bilateral economic relations as well as energy and agricultural cooperation with Moscow will also be addressed during the meeting with Putin. The Iranian president has arrived in Moscow and will be officially received by his Russian counterpart later on Thursday. And that is it for World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The horrific number of Palestinian civilians killed by Zionist regime's airstrikes since the beginning of the latest aggression on Gaza, starting on October 7th, shed light on the Zionist regime's increasing use of artificial intelligence to select its targets. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, as the Zionist regime renewed its strikes recently, After a truce, at least 300 Palestinians have already been killed, adding to at least 15,000 Palestinians killed in the first phase of the war. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, 70% of the casualties are women and children. An investigation carried out jointly by Israeli-Palestinian newspaper Plus 972 magazine and the Hebrew publication Local Call revealed that the Israeli army's expanded authorization for bombing non-military targets and the use of an artificial intelligence system to generate more potential targets than ever before appear to have contributed to the destructive nature of the initial stages of Israel's current war on the Gaza Strip. Palestine Chronicle added, the investigation was reportedly based on conversations with seven current and former members of Israel's intelligence community, in addition to Palestinian testimonies, data, and documentation from the Gaza Strip, and official statements by the IDF spokesperson and other Israeli regime institutions. The indiscriminate bombing, according to the report, is mainly intended to harm Palestinian civil society. According to a source, this practice is aimed to create a shock that, among other things, will reverberate powerfully and lead civilians to put pressure on Hamas. Several sources who spoke with the two outlets on the condition of anonymity confirmed that the Israeli army has files on the vast majority of potential targets in Gaza, including homes, which stipulate the number of civilians who are likely to be killed in an attack on a particular target. Another source asserted that nothing happens by accident. The source reportedly said that when a 3-year-old girl is killed in a home in Gaza, it's because someone in the army decided it wasn't a big deal for her to be killed, that it was a price worth paying in order to hit another target. We are not Hamas. These are not random rockets. Everything is intentional. We know exactly how much collateral damage there is in every home. The investigation blames a large number of civilian targets to a particular artificial intelligence system called Hapsora or the Gospel. Plus 972 magazine reported, this AI system, as described by a former intelligence officer, essentially facilitates a mass assassination factory. One of the sources explained that the Gospel processes enormous amounts of data that tens of thousands of intelligence officers could not process. The system, according to a former Israeli intelligence officer, enables the Israeli army to run a mass assassination factory in which the emphasis is on quantity and not on quality. The report said, five different sources confirmed that the number of civilians who may be killed in attacks on private residents is known in advance to Israeli intelligence and appears clearly in the target file under the category of collateral damage. One of the sources specified that when the general directive becomes collateral damage 5, that means we are authorized to strike all targets that will kill 5 or less civilians, we can act on all target files that are 5 or less. According to Guardian, The Guardian can reveal new details about the Gospel, artificial intelligence, and its central role in the Zionist regime's war in Gaza using interviews with intelligence sources and little-noticed statements made by the IDF and retired officials. This article also draws on testimonies published by Israeli-Palestinian publication Plus 972 magazine and the Hebrew-language outlet Local Call, which have interviewed several current and former sources in the Zionist regime's intelligence community who have knowledge of the gospel platform. Their comments offer a glimpse inside a secretive, artificial intelligence-facilitated military intelligence unit that is playing a significant role in the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza. The slowly emerging picture of how Israel's military is harnessing artificial intelligence comes against a backdrop of growing concerns about the risks posed to civilians as advanced militaries around the world expand the use of complex and opaque automated systems on the battlefield. A former White House security official familiar with the U.S. military's use of autonomous systems said, "Other states are going to be watching and learning." The Zionist regime's war on Gaza would be an important moment if the IDF is using artificial intelligence in a significant way to make targeting choices with life and death consequences, they claimed.
Encircled.
The Jordan Valley is the east part of the occupied West Bank. It's the only gate, the only border for the Palestinian to communicate with the international community, especially with the Arab countries. The Jordan Valley is considered as the basket food for the Palestinian people, where you can harvest in the middle of winter. And this big area, which is about 30% of the West Bank, also considered as a kind of nest for the future of the Palestinian state.
This village of Al-Aqaba is tiny, but at the same time, it's an excellent focal point for understanding the situation today on the West Bank. In 1967, 2,000 people lived in this community. Today, only scattered families remain.
Well, the way that Israel treats the Palestinian population inside Area C is as an enemy, hostile population, effectively, as a population that is not welcome there. And so it's doing everything it can to make life very difficult for them.
To understand the political situation today on the West Bank, we have to go back to the year 1453. This was the point in history where the Turks conquered the ancient city of Constantinople, now Istanbul, and established the Ottoman Empire. For the next four centuries, the Palestinian territory was ruled by the Turks, whose main interest was the collection of taxes. As such, the region's history was relatively uneventful. And it is during this period when many of the current Al-Aqaba residents settled. Then, during the First World War, the Turkish government sided with the Germans, a decision not smart, as Germany was defeated and the Ottoman Empire subsequently broken apart. It was during this period that the British took control under what was called the British Mandate. It was also during this period when European Jews began to immigrate to the region under a political philosophy called Zionism, a desire to establish a Jewish homeland. Tensions grew between these immigrants and the native population, and the British turned to the newly created United Nations to help sort out the problem they had helped create in the first place. In 1948, the UN, in a vote of the General Assembly, created Israel, and immediately a war broke out between Israel and its Arab neighbors. After a series of brutal battles in which tens of thousands of Palestinians fled, an armistice was established and Jordan took control of the area known as the West Bank, or west of the Jordan River. Then, again in 1967, a war broke out between Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. Israel decidedly won this conflict and in the process occupied the West Bank, wresting control from Jordan. This occupation continues today and is the core of the ongoing struggle. In an effort to find resolution, a series of secret talks took place in Oslo, Norway in 1993. The result was a plan to divide the West Bank into three areas, A, B, and C. Area A, the major cities such as Ramallah and Jenin, would fall under Palestinian civil and political control. Area B would be jointly controlled, these areas being mostly areas containing medium-sized communities. And Area C would be the rural areas, primarily the Jordan Valley. Under the accords, this division of land was to exist for 5 years, during which time a final status agreement would be drawn. This agreement, however, has never come about, and the division of land is still very much in place, and the Palestinian population is constantly reminded of that fact.
Really, for Palestinians in Area C, the way that Israel treats them is as a hostile population. It makes their lives as difficult as possible. Most of the population in Area C, Palestinian population, are rural communities. Their livelihoods are based on agriculture. And so the two things they need more than anything else are land and water. This is what they need, the essentials of their lives. And so what Israel is doing is taking both those elements away from them. It's restricting their access to their land. It's using various means to do that. It's confiscating a lot of land, declaring it state land. It's creating military zones, firing zones. A fifth of the Area C are firing zones, military firing zones. And the goal, of course, is to remove them from their land in Area C and move them into Areas B and ideally into Area A.
No one exemplifies this situation better than Othman Spey. Growing up in El Aqaba, he was forced to move to the neighboring Area B town of Tayasir. He now commutes back to El Aqaba each day to supervise production in the community's organic tea cooperative.
Ultimately, what Israel wants is it wants it all. It wants the whole of the West Bank. The question is whether it can get away with doing that. And it certainly can't get away with doing it in one fell swoop. So what it's doing is what famous Israeli general Moshe Dayan called creeping annexation. It's slowly, incrementally taking the land away from the Palestinians. And it's focusing most of its efforts on the rural land, the agricultural land, the largest part of the West Bank. And so slowly, Area C is being ethnically cleansed. There are fewer and fewer Palestinians. We know, for instance, that in 1967, there were about 250,000 Palestinians just in the Jordan Valley itself. Today, the best figures we have suggest there are around 100,000 Palestinians in the whole of Area C. So it's quite clear, it's a very graphic illustration of quite how effective the ethnic cleansing policies have been over 4 or 5 decades. They've really cleared the area out.
Think about it. Just let us think that those Palestinian Bedouin families who live in almost about 52 communities without any kind of service, it's denied by the occupation to have even fresh water. They can hear water running in the pipes under their feet, but they can't drink from it. The electricity wires is crossing over their tent, but they can't. It's just for the Zionist Jewish colony in the Jordan Valley. People stay in the Jordan Valley because they feel that it's just the only place where they can have their own dignity. And those people who are staying without all kind of the service, they belong. They are part of the soil. They are part of the climate, and they will never leave.
Even as the mayor works towards finding an equitable solution, ironically, immediately across the road from El Aqaba's welcome sign is the home of Ahmed Hamdan. His house is under demolition orders, and he and his family go to sleep each evening with fears of waking to the sounds of tanks and military bulldozers coming up the road to level his home.
I think what the Israeli wants, or what the leadership of this state, which is called Israel, and maybe other groups in this area, they want a sustainable resources for their personal future. Because I don't think that the Israeli political leadership, they are trying to achieve real peace in this area. But because this place is an important junction in the world, and the Israeli state and the Israeli, you know, leadership, they want to show the European and the international community that they are the ones who can control this international junction. So they want to keep making a crisis. They want to keep fighting forever. So they will continue receiving help and support from the international community, claiming that the only people who can protect and keep this junction as a secure place in the middle of the world.
But once the IDF decides to declare an area as a firing zone, it's a very large area. It's actually bigger than Area A, which is under Palestinian control. So these large areas, which are declared as military, as firing zones, then become closed military areas, which means that the army then has kind of a free range to do what it wants to do. It can move Palestinians out. It says it's not safe for them there. And it clears the population out. In a way, it's trying to do it as though it's some kind of humanitarian gesture. We don't want you getting caught up in our military maneuvers, so you have to move out. But of course, it's all a pretext for getting Palestinians off their land and out of their homes. In terms of the whole problem of what's going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians, the pressure on the international community is to enforce international law. You know, that's what it's there for, and it's been ignored for decades. Or it's been overlooked, or it's been twisted. But, you know, the international law is fairly clear about what happens here, that this is Palestinian land. It's part of, you know, we have many resolutions in the UN affirming this. So the international community needs to act. It needs to enforce international law. That's what it's there for.
What do you see in the near future here in the Jordan Valley?
It's not color or white picture. And I hope it will not be more black. Because what's going on in the Jordan Valley is a kind of ethnic cleansing, or maybe more. It's genocide, because there is an authority, which is Israeli authority, making all kind of pressure, all kind of collective punishment against those who still, or those who managed to exist on the Jordan Valley from the Palestinian community, replacing them with a new kind of people, which is Jewish community. And of course, this is more than ethnic cleansing. What's going on in the Jordan Valley is a kind of stealing the Palestinian resources. That means it's stealing the future of the Palestinian new generation, and it will not be acceptable at all.
For people in America who really don't know about the West Bank, who really don't know anything at all about the Jordan Valley, what's the most important thing they should know about this place?
We are human beings. I'm a man like you, and my children is like any other children all over the world. It's shame to have this kind of racist apartheid regime in the Holy Land.
You know, the future for people in Area C, I think, is bleak unless the international community is prepared to actually do something. Israel's focus is on Area C. This is the goal, the immediate goal. And so it's been working for decades on getting Palestinians out of Area C. It's been very successful. And every indication is it's going to continue being very successful unless the international community steps in to act. Palestinians can't live there if their lives are being made impossible. If they're surrounded by tanks and firing ranges and it's impossible for them to get water, to get access to their land, there's no way that they can sustain their lives there. It becomes impossible. And so unless we're going to do something about it, we have to say the Area C is gone.
America is the main support state, or the main resources for supporting Israel. So our message to the American, first of all, don't pay for our killers. Don't pay your money to a place where you don't know.
You know, the most important thing for Americans to know about what's happening in the West Bank right now is that what we're seeing is a process of sustained ethnic cleansing, the theft of land, the theft of resources, of water, and it's being paid for largely by American taxpayers. They're subsidizing this process of ethnic cleansing. It's being done in their name. And because of that, there's a responsibility, a moral responsibility on Americans to stand up and say, no, it has to stop, it has to end now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
According to a recent analysis of government data, the typical American household must spend an additional $11,434 annually just to maintain the same standard of living that they enjoyed in January of 2021, right before inflation soared to a 40-year high. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Newsweek magazine has covered this story and tells us more. According to a recent survey, many Americans will be skipping or cutting back on holiday gifts this year as they continue to struggle against inflation. While inflation is cooling in the United States, it is continuing to squeeze budgets, causing some Americans to rethink their gift-giving traditions. According to WalletHub's 2023 holiday shopping survey, about 34% of respondents are choosing to skip presents altogether due to financial pressures. Emily, a 42-year-old teacher in Chicago, told Newsweek, "I've always loved the holiday spirit, but this year we had to make tough choices." She explained that there will be fewer gifts under the Christmas tree for her two children and admitted the gifts she usually buys her students will be replaced with handcraft cards with personalized notes of encouragement. The teacher added that she is doing what she can even if it's not through physical presence. And Emily isn't alone. According to WalletHub, half of the American population will buy fewer gifts for their children this year. The lingering effects of last year's spending are still felt by many. The WalletHub survey indicates that nearly one in four Americans are still paying off holiday debts, leading to more cautious spending this Christmas season. Emily said, "Last year left us with a hefty credit card bill. but noted she was able to pay off holiday debts by the spring season. The survey also found that about 19% of people will apply for a new credit card to help with holiday shopping, a sign of the financial juggling act that many are facing. To that end, a growing number are choosing to spend less, with 28% planning to reduce their holiday budget compared to last year. NerdWallet's 2023 holiday shopping report found more than one in three shoppers are now opting for experiences with loved ones over traditional gift exchanges. About 30% of holiday shoppers are leaning towards receiving fewer gifts, and nearly a quarter are setting spending limits with friends and family. Austin Scarpelli, a student at the University of Illinois in Chicago, previously told Newsweek, "Social media usually tempts me to splurge, but this year is different." Newsweek previously reported the trend of spending less or not at all is expected to extend through the holiday season, with roughly 75% of the American public planning to cut back on non-essential expenditures over the next 6 months. Wallet Hub found charitable giving, another holiday staple, is also impacted by inflation, with nearly half of the respondents saying it will affect their donations to charity. Meanwhile, the website of Axios.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. Food banks have found themselves amid a rock and a hard place as donations are plummeting amid surging demand. Divert Inc., an impact technology company, has found that inflation and mounting grocery prices are preventing Americans from making donations during the holiday season. Typically, holidays are a time when American consumers are more likely to assist those in need. The company's report reads, only 25% of respondents said they are more likely to donate during this year's holiday season compared to previous years. Those who are donating less to food banks this season cite increasing food and grocery prices as the number one reason driving the decision. The technology company also revealed that the current economic climate in the United States prompted 72% of the American public to change their grocery shopping habits. 51% of respondents said that grocery prices are forcing them to cut costs in other areas. What's more, 25% of consumers expressed anxiety about their ability to afford food over the next 3 to 6 months. 30% said that they are now buying less fresh food like produce as prices bite. According to Divert, 85% of respondents believe that food insecurity countrywide has surged since the COVID-19 pandemic ended. Furthermore, 63% suggest that the United States is far more food insecure than the latest United States Department of Agriculture data indicates. According to the United States Department of Agriculture data, food insecurity started climbing in 2022, for the first time in more than a decade, with 44 million Americans living in food insecure households last year, which constitutes a 31% increase since the previous year, 2021. Out of this number, 13 million children were food insecure in 2022 in the United States, a 44% spike since last year. For its part, Feeding America, a network of 200 food banks, cited surging demand for food assistance across the United States. A network of 47 food pantries in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, has registered a 50% increase in visits. Morgan's food banks in Oregon have also seen a 50% surge in demand this year. A survey by Parents Together Action, a non-profit family advocacy organization, shows that 7 in 10 lower- and middle-income parents were struggling to afford food ahead of Thanksgiving. According to U.S. media, it's the first holiday season when people in need are enduring growing pressures without the federal government's pandemic-era food assistance, which was halted back in March. National broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a recent analysis of government data, the typical American household must spend an additional $11,434 annually just to maintain the same standard of living that they enjoyed in January of 2021, right before inflation soared to a 40-year high. Such figures underscore the financial squeeze that many families are continuing to face even as the rate of inflation recedes and the economy, by many measures, remains purportedly strong, with a so-called low jobless rate. The analysis from Republican members of the U.S. Senate Joint Economic Committee taps government data such as the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, and the Consumer Expenditure Survey to examine the impact of inflation state by state. According to a CBS News opinion poll, even so, many Americans say they aren't feeling those gains, and this fall, more people reported struggling financially than they did prior to the pandemic. Inflation is the main reason Americans express pessimism about economy despite its bright points, which also included stronger wage gains in recent years. To be sure, economists point to a number of pandemic-related issues as a cause of high inflation, rather than decisions from any one political party. For instance, spending bills were signed by both presidents, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, that put stimulus money into the hands of millions of Americans, while global supply chain snarls and labor shortages drove up the cost of goods and services. But even as inflation is now cooling off, many consumers say they aren't feeling it, with a new Bankrate survey finding 60% of working Americans say their income has lagged inflation over the past 12 months. According to government data, the average hourly pay for workers in the United States has increased robustly 13.6% since January of 2021, although that lags the 17% increase in inflation during the same time period. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. This is IRIB English Radio.